Welcome to the Nerd of the Rings podcast. To get the latest Middle-earth related videos, including Tolkien Explained, Complete Travels, and Theories, visit youtube.com/nerdoftherings. This audio podcast is made possible by the support of my wonderful Patreon supporters. To learn how you can score some exclusive perks while supporting the channel, visit patreon.com/nerdoftherings. Welcome everyone to Nerd of the Rings. Today we have a very special guest that I'm extremely excited to have on the show. He is one of the most well-known Tolkien scholars in the world, and I think he's making a run for guest with the most books on my bookshelf. It is Dr. Tom Shippey. Tom, thank you so much for joining me today. I've long been a great admirer of your work. I came to the fandom through the Peter Jackson films and have since been, you know, over the last 20 years have been diving deeper into this amazing world. And your works have been such a huge part of that.
Well, thanks very much, Matt. I got to say, I did a lecture a few days ago, which was called, 60 years of Tolkien. And I, in fact, went back and checked the dates. And although 60 years is a long time and I forget things, that does seem to be about when I started my involvement. Having said that, I should just say two things quickly. One is I've had COVID. So sometimes I cough and my voice is a bit funny. And the other thing is I'm having a tooth implant. But of course, it's been stopped because I had COVID. So if my voice sounds a bit funny and if I look a bit funny, well, I'm sorry. That's the way it is.
I'm glad you're on the mend, though. I know you're talking a bit. And it seems like you're on the mend. So that's good. So right off the bat, folks familiar with this channel, no doubt are familiar with some of your Tolkien related books or strictly Tolkien related, I should say, because even this new one has to do with Tolkien a bit. Probably author of the century, Road to Middle-earth, things like that. Today, first, we're going to talk about the new Beowulf translation and commentary that you did with Leonard. So tell us about this book.
Basically, this is what's it say? Beowulf, translation and commentary. Translation is me. Commentary is my friend, Professor Nydorf. And the basic idea, I think, well, there are two basic ideas. One is this is a one-stop Beowulf, a full-service Beowulf, because there's lots of translations, but there's no commentary with them. There's a number of commentaries, but they don't have translations. Well, this has the text of the poem, so you can see what it is. It has my translation, so you can see what it says, and it has Len's commentary, so you can get an idea of what it means. And you've also got a very large bibliography, so if you have the patience, you can find out what other people think or thought it meant or means or whatever. So one stop, full service. Yeah, that's one point. And the other is it's hands-on. A lot of translations, and I'm not going to start knocking anybody, but a lot of translations are created by a kind of team. There's an old English specialist who kind of tells the translator what the poem says, and he then puts it into his own words. Well, that's not entirely satisfactory. And also, a lot of the time, I think people just look words up in the back of the book. A common exercise for students, and they assume that's right, but it isn't always right. I think you need to know the poem pretty well, in fact, very well, to understand what it says, because things change according to context. And I think that, you know, I've been reading Beowulf for more than 60 years, and Professor Nydorf, he's only a young chap of about 40 odd, but he has 20 years of experience and has written two books about Beowulf, so he knows this stuff as well. So we think that, as I say, it's a one-stop, full-service book, and it's also, as regards the translation, a hands-on one. And I think one of the results of that, it's very difficult to kind of get rid of embedded prejudices, and there is a strong feeling around. And I can't think why it is that while Anglo-Saxons were fine, strong, upright, stolid people, they were also a bit simple. They weren't, come to think of it, very clever. So you couldn't expect anything very clever from them. And the poem then, while full of violence and heroic deeds and so on, well, it's not very subtle. Well, that's dead wrong. I can only say that I think the Anglo-Saxon ideal, I have to say it in Italian, actually, is volto sciolto, pensieri stretti, open face, closed thoughts. So the fact that there appear to be, well, you've got to look beneath the surface is what I'm saying. Yeah. And I think I'd add, you know, just as a comment, that if the work was in fact designed for armed retainers, military bodyguards, not being able to take a hint is actually a very poor survival quality when you are dealing with people like that. You had better pick up on a hint or else, well, the results could be catastrophic and indeed fatal. So I think listening carefully to what people say and to what they don't say is very important. And that, I hope, I, especially in the translation, have tried to get across. Well, okay. Next thing, what would you like me to do next?
I'm just along for the ride here. I'm happy to listen to whatever you have to say, honestly. But I'm curious with this new Beowulf book and just looking at this tale that is so old. I believe you, as well as Tolkien, place it at around the 8th century.
Yes.
And what is it about this tale that has this lasting power that, you know, people are still studying it and even doing new translations of it so long after the fact?
Well, for a start, it's kind of unique. You know, it's the only long narrative poem we have in Old English or in any early Germanic language, which is not a translation of something else. That's one thing. It's also, I think, I always say, it's a stratified poem. At bottom, in my opinion, there is an old fairy tale about the bear's son, and Beowulf is the bear's son. He's very like a bear. He's terribly strong. He fights hand to hand. He's a very good swimmer. When he was young, they thought he was a bit, the word the poem uses, slack. Lazy, maybe, unenterprising, but that's true of bears' sons as well, because they're not entirely human. Well, there's that fairy tale element. But the poet, I think, didn't really want that. He wanted it to be an aristocratic poem with a very strong sense of dignity and courtesy and proper behavior and all that kind of thing. And this is where I disagree with Tolkien. Well, I don't, actually. I disagree with what Tolkien said, but I don't disagree with what Tolkien thought. Tolkien said in his famous lecture that you've got to stop thinking of the poem as just a historical document. And I quite see his point. People have been doing that for decades and had got very silly about it. I won't go into that, but they got very, very silly about it. But actually, Tolkien took it quite seriously as a historical document, and long after 1936, other things came out which make it quite clear that he took it historically. And in a way, the poem then has its, you know, fight against Grendel, fight against Grendel's mother, fight against the dragon. But in between, there's a build-up, there's an interlude, there's an interlude, there's a wind-down. And all these are full of historical allusions. And I do wish, actually, I often wish this, I wish I could talk to Tolkien about it. Yeah. Because, you see, we've found things out that he didn't know about. He died 50 years ago. But since then, the poem has been actually, I think, rather surprisingly corroborated by archaeology. The thing about archaeology is, you know, they keep digging things up. that's really sort of certainly altered my view on it. But it hasn't altered the view of the general public or most of the scholarly public. One thing, I just finished by saying, one thing Tolkien said, which I thought was very, very astute. He said he thought the really original thing, the real stroke of genius by the Beowulf poet, was he set the poem at exactly the right time. And we can, in fact, date the setting of the poem pretty accurately, which you wouldn't expect, but we can. And it is set in the early years of the 6th century, which, as I put it somewhere or other, I say that was the time just before the roof fell in for Scandinavia. It was just before what my learned colleague, Professor Heskin, says was the cold decade. The cold decade when the sun didn't come through, where the summers didn't happen, where the harvests were feeble, and when people died of hunger. And that was part of it, but it was only part of it because there was also failure in attempts to raid. That's one of the main events of Beowulf. And there's also, it appears, and again, the archaeology tends to confirm this, there was civil war all over Scandinavia, which is what happens, you know, when the resources run out. They were all, anyway, so that I think gives us yet another perspective on the poem. Okay, so I think it's a very stratified poem, and it's a very subtle poem, and you've got to read it carefully and without these presuppositions. And it does help also if you know the bloody grammar of the language. I'm sorry to speak sharply about this, but I spent my life teaching the bloody grammar of the language, and it doesn't seem to have worked, you know, Matt. Well, there we go. Shall I give you an example?
Yes, absolutely.
Right, here's the book, let me just say that if you're interested in it, you go to our website, which is upsellabooks.com, click on catalog of books, and you'll see there not only this book, but the second one we've published, which is the translation of the Bhagavad Gita, and the things that are coming up. So you can see our future as well as our present. Anyway, upsellabooks.com, have a look at it. Let me put this in perspective. Beowulf has killed Grendel. Everybody's really happy, you know. Drinks all round, and here come the medals. Yeah. And at this point, the Queen of the Danes, Wealhtheow, comes forward and speaks to her husband. Now, her husband has a couple of hundred lines before, in the joy of his heart, after the defeat of Grendel, said he doesn't use the word adopt because they hadn't got the word adopt yet, but he's going to treat him as a son. I will hold you as a son. And the queen, of course, how does she react to that? Well, here's her speech. Now, listen carefully. She's talking to her husband. She's talking to her husband in public with everybody listening. Things have to be said carefully. See what she says. See what she doesn't say. Shall I give you the original text first?
Sure.
She says in Anglo-Saxon, "On fo this and fuller Freodrichten mean sinches Britta, though on Salem wares Goldwin Agumina onto Yertum sprach Mildum Wardum swashal man don. Bear with Yertus glad Jovena Gumendi Nan and Fairan thou thou new havest." May man cider that do they for sunu walda herinch haban. Herot is you felsod, bechsela biochta, brook thenden thu mota, manigra medo, ondinum margum lef, falcon reacher, thonu thu forth shiller, meotedshaft sound. I won't give you the rest of it, but I also stressed the words which I think are grammatically important, and I'll have to explain that. Here's my translation. I'm not going to do it in a female voice, but because that would sound silly. But remember, this is a queen talking to her husband in public at a moment of festivity, and she says, Take this cup, my noble lord, gold friend of men, and to the Yeats, speak kind words, as is only right. Be generous to the Yeats, think of gifts for them, all that you have, from far and near. I was told you wish to have the warrior as your son. Heorot has been cleansed, the bright ring hall. Enjoy the praise of many as long as permitted to you, and leave folk and kingdom to your own sons, when you must pass on and see destiny. I know my gracious Hrothulf will honor the young ones. Anyway, I won't give you the rest of the speech, but it is clear, I think, though it wasn't clear for a long, long time because people didn't get it. It's clear that the queen is miffed.
Yes.
And the reason she's miffed is because adopting a stranger creates a challenger to her own sons. And the other thing that she is carefully not saying is when you die, and of course it's stressed that her husband Hrothgar is extremely old. Yeah. He's old, he's white-haired, he's not going to be with us much longer, so there is going to be a succession issue. Let's not make it any worse. Indeed, I can't help thinking that the word which is missing, and which of course I haven't put in, though I felt like it, is but. She says, you know, enjoy the praise of many as long as permitted to you, but leave folk and kingdom to your own sons when you must pass on and see destiny, which will be very soon. Well, I added some bits there, as you probably know. But of course, she carefully doesn't say when you die. And actually, the words I stressed are two modal verbs. I was sent off only once by the referee, and that was for giving him a lecture on modal verbs, and he didn't like it. There we go. She says then, perhaps the important one is leave to your kinsmen, folk and kingdom, Thonna thu forth shilla. Actually, the normal way of saying that would be Thonna thu forth shalt, thou shalt, when you shall go forth and see destiny. But she doesn't say shalt. She says shilla. And that is a subjunctive, not an indicative. And a subjunctive is what you use when it's kind of hypothetical, not happening, far off. So she says, you know, I can't translate that into modern English. It's something like when perhaps in the course of time it may be that you, but that's too long, isn't it? But she says it again when she says, Bruk senden thu mota. Thu mota, well, normally that would be thu most when you will be allowed to. But she says, so Bruk senden thu mota, what did I say? Enjoy the praise of many as long as permitted to you. Yes, as long as maybe will be, as long as we hope will be permitted, you know, it's all far off. It's quite clear that three times she says, when you die, but she doesn't say when you die.
Yeah.
She avoids saying when you die, but that's what she means. This is the thing that she doesn't say. The other thing, and I cut this bit of the speech out, but having told him she doesn't want Beowulf as a challenger to her own children, get it? She then turns around and talks to the other guy up there, who is the king's nephew and co-regent at the time, seems to be associated with him in ruling the place. And he is obviously a threat because he's in his prime. He's got, you know, he's got the backing. And she says twice, you know, I know Hrothel, jolly nice chap, he'll look after our children if you die before him, which of course you're going to. And I know he'd be really good as long as he remembers all the things we've done for him. Well, the first if it should happen that you leave the world before he should do so, yes, that's going to happen. But if he remembers the favors we have done to honor and please him while he was a child, maybe that's not going to happen. So the two ifs are, well, pointing in different directions, but she doesn't want them to together. Well, we got three competitors, you might say. Wealthy has two sons who haven't appeared yet, but they will in a moment, and Beowulf, and Hrothulf. And the fact is that perhaps a surprising thing in the poem, which has not been hinted at before, is that she switches from Beowulf to Hrothulf. And the only connection between the two of them is she sees them both as a danger.
Mm.
But Beowulf isn't, but Hrothulf is. Okay, story behind that, which we think we've figured out, but, you know, it doesn't say it. The poem doesn't say it. You've got to figure it out. Right. Well, that's my saying about Beowulf. It's a plumbing difficult work.
Yeah.
And I would also say that, this is perhaps me being rude, but the people least fitted to understand it are modern academics. Because modern academics like to gas on and on and on and on, and then write pages and pages and pages of footnotes so they get everything straight. Whereas the normal Anglo-Saxon mode of speech is, as we used to say in my youth, a nod's as good as a wink to a blind horse. they speak elusively. They speak elliptically. They do not. And of course, they're English. What do English people do? What do English people not do? Betray their feelings. Gosh, if we started betraying our feelings, we'd all turn into Americans, wouldn't we? That'd be terrible. So no, it's a very kind of I can only say the same thing again. It's a subtle, indirect poem which deserves really very detailed study. Okay, that's my pitch.
I like what you know. Go on. I've heard you in some of your lectures before. You know, you mentioned how there's so much focus on the three action set pieces. You know, with Grendel, Grendel's mother, and the dragon. But you make the point, you know, there's so much that goes on in between those. And, you know, I think you just demonstrated there with the part with the queen. You know, there's a lot that people don't realize, especially if, you know, you're relying on, humorously, I watched the Beowulf animated adaptation the other day from, gosh, like 10 years ago or something, just to pique my curiosity in remembering back when that came out. But yeah, if you rely on some adaptations, you kind of get the impression that there's only these action set pieces, not to mention vast changes. But that aside, I just thought that was interesting, you know, as you've made that point before. In the book, you also have a section, you said you have an appendix on Tolkien and Beowulf. So what can readers expect to find in there?
Well, you know, I think it's called a lifelong involvement. And I tried to set out, you know, what Tolkien probably, the things that inspired him from an early stage to a late stage. But I see at the end, I say, I think Tolkien identified himself with the Beowulf poet. How deeply this identification went, we shall never know, more, no doubt, than this brief appendix has been able to prove. And of course, as soon as I kind of finished that sentence, I thought of another one. and it's a thought I've tried to express before, and I've always got it wrong because I've tried to compress it too much. So if you don't mind, I'll just try to set it out slowly without getting it wrong for a change. Well, what I think is the striking similarities between Beowulf and Tolkien, between the Beowulf poet and Tolkien are, one, they were both committed Christians. Two, they set their works in a pre-Christian period so that the characters in them could not possibly be Christians.
Yes.
But both of them were very reluctant to condemn the characters for being pre-Christians. Mm. Now, the word that Christians use, and nobody else uses, is heathen in Old English. And it means, of course, non-Christians. Well, the word is used, I always get this wrong, the word is used six times in Beowulf, six times. Mm. But twice it refers to Grendel, twice it refers to the dragon's gold, or a hoard, and only twice does it refer to the characters of the poem. And both times, the word is extremely dubious.
Hmm.
The second time it's used, it refers to the Geats, Beowulf people, and almost all editors, as far as I know, all editors, delete it. Say, no, it's a mistake. The scribe writing 300 years later than the poet is very familiar with the idea of heathens, and he doesn't like them at all. We've had 300 years of the Viking Wars. Yeah, that's why he doesn't like them at all. So he writes heathens. But actually, Tolkien, at least, thought that the word was actually halothum, a very similar word, but just means heroes. So he didn't think the poet called the Ents heathens. There's another passage much earlier on, which again uses the term heathens of the Danes. And Tolkien was dead sure, he's very insistent, that that whole passage, I don't know, 8 or 10 lines or so, must be an interpolation. It was not written by the poet. It's different in its attitude and in its style and language. So he was quite sure that that was phony. So if that's the case, we have two mentions in the poem which say that the characters are heathens, but we don't believe either of them. And when the poet says heathens, he means monsters, not humans.
Right.
Or possibly, in the case of the Dragon's Gold, people from far back. People from far back who buried the gold, which the dragon eventually acquired.
Yeah.
Well, if you look at Lord of the Rings, and I've got one of those searchable versions of it, you can see that Tolkien also uses the word heathen only twice, but not about his characters. Once it's said by Gandalf, once it's said by Denethor, and when they say heathen kings, they mean people far back in the past. Not us. We're not heathens. They're heathens. Actually, you know, they were heathens, but Tolkien isn't going to admit it, and the Beowulf poet wasn't going to admit it either. They both set their works then in a kind of theological limbo.
Yeah.
Never Neverland, which is not Christian, because that wouldn't be true, but not heathen either, because they don't want to think that. And that's a very interesting datum in itself. And of course it raises all kinds of problems, which are actually being seen rather less often than one might think. But then, you know, you read Lord of the Rings, you get swallowed up by it. You don't think about that kind of thing.
Right.
But I just say that, you know, what are aspects of heathendom which later ages did not like? One was slavery. Well, there aren't any in Beowulf. One possible mention, probably not. I don't know. Might be right, might not. Tolkien rejected it, though. One is human sacrifice. Oh, no. It's only Denethor who does that. And he says it's, we'll burn like heathen kings. Yeah. And that's obviously not right at all. When Theoden is buried, it's a very traditional burial in a barrow, and the riders ride round it, just as in Beowulf, saying the praises of the king. But they don't go sacrificing anything.
Right.
Actually, they don't in Beowulf either. But in one description we have of a similar burial, of course they do. You kill the king's horses and his dogs and some slaves as well to accompany him, and you know, very heathen habit. Not allowed. No, don't want to know about that. So slaves, sacrifice, I forget what the other one was, but there are several heathen elements which are just obliterated from both works. Okay, I hope I got that right this time. Six mentions, four are monsters and two are probably mistakes. Okay.
Now, you mentioned there the similarity between the way Theoden is buried and what we see in Beowulf. There's some other similarities too. I've heard you speak before about probably the biggest example being the approach to Rohan, how that mirrors the way Gandalf and the three hunters come to Rohan, it the exact same sequence in Beowulf as comes to Hrothgar. Are there other instances, that pop up in Tolkien that, you know, you look at and you say, oh, that's just like this from Beowulf?
Yeah, well, actually, yes, there is. And it's in The Hobbit. What happens in The Hobbit? Bilbo is sent down the tunnel to rob Smaug. He does. He brings back a cup. The dragon wakes up and realizes, and of course he flies round in rage does his best to catch the people who've done it. What happened? That's The Hobbit. Well, yeah. In Beowulf, it says that, and I said there is only one mention of a slave in Beowulf, and actually right. Tolkien rejected it. The word for slave would be theo, but it could also be theof, thief, and that would make sense as well. Well, what's Bilbo? He's a professional burglar. He's a thief. Right. So yeah. The thief goes down. Anyway, in Beowulf, the thief stumbles upon the hoard. He takes the cup. He takes it away. He gives it to his lord, just as Beowulf hands over the thing to Thorin. And the dragon then comes after him and starts to burn the bright halls. Burn the bright halls, like burning down Lake Town. Yep. Yeah. Okay, so there's a very a complete sequence there, which is much the same. And as I say, it depends very characteristically for Tolkien on kind of altering a letter.
Yeah.
Okay. right. So yes, that's another thing, and I'm sure there are more. Anyway, I made a list of. Proverbs in Tolkien once, and I lost it long ago, but I could actually try to set those against ones in Old English. I think there'd be a good deal of similarity.
Oh, I bet. Yeah, I bet there would.
And the riddles, you know, and the riddles in the contest in The Hobbit, we can find the sources for those, and they too are often ancient. Okay.
Yes.
I suppose what I'm really saying is I think the influence of Beowulf on Tolkien is pervasive. It's there all over the place. In a sort of way, he couldn't manage without it.
Yeah.
We know that Tolkien, didn't quite know what he was doing when he started Lord of the Rings. He just started and he went on and, the ideas came to him slowly. But I think that the moment it all clicked for him was when he solved a problem which had been bothering him. And it's a problem I would notice, but most people wouldn't notice.
Yeah.
And it's this: the dwarves all have Old Norse names. Mm-hmm. Well, how does that work? They've got Old Norse names, and the hobbits just have modern English names. How come the dwarves have got this sort of... Anyway, he solved this by deciding that the dwarves had long ago lived to the east of the known world, and their nearest neighbors were people who spoke something like Old Norse. And next to them, there were people who spoke something like Old English. And next to them, there were people who spoke something like Old English, but they went west. And there the language turned into something like modern English. Well, all this is extremely fanciful, but it's kind of logical.
Yeah.
And Tolkien, I think, figured this out. And I remember thinking, that's the page where he sets it out. And after that, he'd got an excuse for bringing in Old Englishness. And he got an excuse for producing the Riders of Rohan. And after that, it all went much more easily. That's what I think.
Wow.
It's an odd response, yeah.
Yeah, that's so interesting. Like you said, it's something that I don't know if any other author would take the time, to pause their work and work out that issue. I think most would just say, well, they have those names because they have those names.
Yeah, that's right.
leave it to Tolkien to have to, figure the linguistics out.
Yeah. And of course, Tolkien has his characters sort of note this occasionally. Theoden says to the hobbits, what you talk is pretty strange, but actually I kind of recognize some of it. They share a bit of vocabulary.
Yeah. Holbitla.
Holbitla, that's right. Master Holbitla, he says. Yeah. That's right. So he twigs to what the name means. Okay. Pervasive influence. I'm sure other people will find other examples.
Now, one of the things I find really interesting about Tolkien is that you've got this, with the fandom, you've got this huge pop culture side, you know, where there's just this general awareness and love of, you know, obviously the Peter Jackson films came along and you know, probably boosted that quite a bit. But you've always had this, you know, pop culture side, and then you've got this genuine academic study side, and it's really unique. I don't know of anything else that has reached the heights that it has, that Tolkien has, in both of those categories.
Well, I got to say, I don't quite agree with you there, because I'm very conscious that when I got into the business, you know, whenever it was, hundreds of years ago, mentioning Tolkien was academic suicide. Mm. You were immediately regarded as frivolous and ridiculous. Quite a lot of things are academic suicide. I still think, you know, my director of studies back at Queen's College, Cambridge, refused to recommend me for graduate study. He really? Said he didn't think I'd got it. I thought, I'll show you. and I did. The reason was, of course, he realized I actually read science fiction. And obviously that was just not the kind of thing at all. I should be reading much more serious books. I read the serious books. I read science fiction too. Okay, what's the problem? Well, there was a problem. And actually, Tolkien got a very, very hostile reception when Lord of the Rings came out. I once went down to the publishers, Allen and Unwin's. This is a long time ago. And they had a big folder of reviews. And I turned over these reviews one after another. They were very negative. They were very negative. And indeed, when I wrote The Road to Middle-earth, I started off by quoting one of the stupidest of them. But actually, there were so many stupid ones. It was, well, not just stupid, but people who said, oh, well, this isn't going to work. This isn't going to come off. Nobody's going to read this. Wrong.
Yeah.
why did you get it wrong? Perhaps it would be a good idea to think about that. But no, the academic world has been very hostile to Tolkien. Mm. They brought out an issue of one of the journals a few years ago. I think it may have been Modern Philology, and it was essays about Tolkien, and they were all negative. He was bad in every way. Everything was wrong about him. No, you can't be caught reading that stuff. That's what hippies do. So
this is still a problem, you're saying?
It's much less of a problem than it was, because the matter's been decided.
Yeah.
If you think Tolkien's going to go away, well, you must be crazy. So that's that. And also, of course, I know quite well, especially in the US, the students are customers, not in the UK, where it's a kind of state-run enterprise. But in the US, it's the customers decide. And how do you get people to take humanities courses? Mm. Well, every time we ran short on majors in the English department, they'd wheel me out and I'd put on a course on Tolkien with three graduate assistants to help me. We'd get 70 students signing up for it, and many of those would actually decide to be humanities majors or majors in English. So it was a surefire student attractor. And of course, if you're out in a smaller college, and you really got to kind of make your bones, you got to draw them in. Well, teaching Tolkien's a good idea. Teaching fantasy's a good idea. Teaching science fiction is quite a good idea. That's a rather, I don't know, not quite such a popular taste. But yes, the academic world has slowly been pushed and shoved into taking some notice of this. But a lot of the time, they don't like it much. They don't like it much.
Yeah.
I know when I wrote Author of the Century, Tolkien, J.R.R. Tolkien, Author of the Century, some radio show tried to get me to debate this with the famous critic Harold Bloom. And that, I was okay about that. But she was talking to Bloom on the phone and I was listening in, and I could hear him saying, Author of the Century, Author of the Century, has the fella never heard of Marcel Proust? I thought, actually, the fella has heard of Marcel Proust. And if you like, Professor Bloom, we can conduct this interview in French. I'm sure my French is a bloody sight better than yours. But anyway, no, he wouldn't talk to me. Didn't want to know. So that I think was quite predictable.
You mentioned author of the century. For those who aren't familiar, I happen to have a copy of that here as well. But so there it is, author of the century. So you talk a little bit about the naming of that was kind of a can you tell people the story behind choosing that name?
Just me being provocative. I think I thought that'll get them going. Ha 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 ha. And of course it did. Of course I didn't say he was the author of the century because I'm very good at grammar, but he is certainly an author of the century. So you can take it which way you like. Instead, I should say the Road to Middle Earth. Mm-hmm. That was really a kind of imitation of a book. A famous book, and I've forgotten the name of the author, trust me, which is called The Road to Xanadu, I think. Mm. And it was about Coleridge's poem, In Xanadu did Kubla Khan a stately pleasure dome decree. And this was a book of which another prominent critic said, this is a book of a kind we want only one of. Okay, Buster, well, you're going to get two of them now. Yeah. Perhaps I should say that during my academic career, most of the time, I was not a professor of English literature. I was, just like Tolkien, a professor of English language. Hmm. And my job was to fight the professors of English literature. And so it was with Tolkien, actually. And we always lost because we were outnumbered. But in a way, Tolkien turned the tables on them. And that's another reason they don't like him. He showed them up. He proved they were wrong. Huh. Well, tough luck, buddy.
Yeah.
I'll get into a bad temper, so I'd better shut up.
Now, you also, you know, we talked earlier about Beowulf being an inspiration and an effect on Tolkien. Another thing, obviously, that's been noted countless times is his involvement in World War One, and you mentioned before we started recording when we were corresponding that you just released an article recently about Tolkien in World War One.
Yes, that's right. It was actually written by me and my old friend John Bourne, who is a real World War One historian, we called it A Steep Learning Curve: Tolkien on the Somme. And this was reviewed in Tolkien Studies, I thought, by somebody who just missed the point entirely. Mm-hmm. And I'm surprised because I thought we made the point very clear. And the point was this. There was a very big difference between July the 1st, 1916, the Black Day of the British Army, when poor Rob Gilson was killed, Tolkien's friend, and October the 16th, 1916, when Tolkien went over the top. Because the July attack was not a complete failure, but a major disaster. And Tolkien's attack was totally successful. In fact, you know, in the article, we spell this out in some detail, quoting the German comments on the whole thing. No, it was, and that was because we called it a steep learning curve in the July, August, September, half of October, in the kind of 14 weeks, 100 days between the two attacks, the British Army had realized it had got things wrong. And it wasn't going to do that again. And so not only were people retrained, not only was it an entirely different attitude, they were also given different weapons. Tolkien's attack was so successful that after it, I mean, this is amazing, really. After it, his battalion was paraded and congratulated by the brigade commander. The next day, it was paraded and congratulated by the division commander. The next day, it was paraded and congratulated by the corps commander. And the next day, it was paraded and congratulated by the boss himself, you know, Field Marshal Haig. Well, is that going out in a blaze of glory? The day after that, Tolkien went sick with trench fever. So his last, as it were, experience on the Somme was being congratulated again and again and again and again. What I'm saying, and this is what obviously people can't understand. They've got fixed in their head the idea, which of course Humphrey Carpenter rubber stamped, that everything in World War One was a disaster, it was futile, it was silly, it was mud and blood and incompetence all over the place. No, that was not true. But if you want to believe it, you know, I can't kind of talk you out of believing it, but in Tolkien's case, it was completely mistaken. So, and that meant, I think, that after World War One, there was a general air of disillusionment and irony, and you couldn't use the word hero without people sneering at you. There's a famous book called Death of a Hero by an Australian called Adlington. Don't read it. It's really miserable. And you also got Robert Graves writing Goodbye to All That. Okay, goodbye to all that. Tolkien didn't say goodbye to all that. He invented heroic fantasy. He produced new ideas of the hero and old ideas of the hero. Because his experience was different. Anyway, that was our point. The guy in Tolkien study just didn't get it because, you know, it was contradicting something he'd known since he was a toddler, and he couldn't get his head around it. So I put it up on Academia. It's on academia.edu. Type in, actually, you better type in the paper title correctly because the recognition isn't very good. A Steep Learning Curve, : Tolkien and the British Army on the Somme. And then you can read it. And I've actually put the Tolkien Studies notice at the bottom and invited people to see what they think.
And I'll make sure for folks watching this, I'll have the link to that in the description, as well as the link to the new Beowulf book as well.
Yes, of course. That's good. Good.
Yeah.
Could I say one other thing?
Yeah, absolutely.
This is Tolkien related as well. Last year, I brought out a little book, which is called Beowulf and the North. Beowulf and the North before the Vikings.
Yes. Yeah.
And this is, in a way, an argument with Tolkien saying, no, we must take it as history seriously. But it's also, in a way, a dialogue between Tolkien young and Tolkien old. Because in his later years, these books came out posthumously, it was quite clear what he thought about history in Beowulf. And he was right. And he's been corroborated by the archaeologists. So there, when he told people, you know, to forget about history, I don't think he really meant it. In fact, I know he didn't really mean it. But later years would, I think, even more have changed his mind. So it's a study of Tolkien's attitudes, Tolkien's changes of mind. And I hope people would like to have a look at that.
Yeah. So that is Beowulf in the North before the Vikings, you said,
that's
right?
That's right. I remember we had an argument with the publishers. I always have arguments with publishers. And he said, oh, no. He said, he came up with something else. I said, no, listen, there's only two things that people know about the Middle Ages. One is King Arthur and the other is Vikings. So we've got to put Vikings in the title, even though there aren't any in the bloody book. Just the same, we'll say before the Vikings.
Now, that is kind of amusing to me that, you know, you have this, you know, Tolkien's young and Tolkien old kind of, you know, arguing, you know, correct, or one correcting the other. I kind of laugh, you know, internally when you said that, because who better to, you know, have an argument with Tolkien than Tolkien himself?
Exactly. That's right. Well, yes. But, you know, I said Beowulf was a stratified poem and Tolkien was a kind of stratified person, you know. I mean, he again was a very clear case of the open faced, hidden thoughts. Yeah. You had to listen carefully to him to get what he was on about. And I don't think people did that much. He was too clever for them.
Yeah.
Yes. Well, that was my conclusion anyway. what else can I comment on?
So you mentioned Viking, and I hadn't originally planned on talking about this, but since you brought up Vikings, the other book, one of the other ones I have back there on the shelf is your book, Laughing Shall I Die? I thought is a very interesting book. What, tell us a little bit about that one.
Well, first I say, you know, I mentioned the Beowulf book, I mentioned the Laughing Shall I Die. Have a look at my new website, tomshippey.com, and they're all there, so that's okay. Yeah. Laughing Shall I Die, well, I was in an airport, it was Schiphol Airport in Amsterdam, and looking at the shelves of books, you know, and I saw one which is effectively 10 top generals, and then there was another one which is kind of 10 top admirals, and I thought, 10 top Vikings, what can go wrong? So off I went, and I decided to, I don't think it was came out as 10 in the end, you know, but I got a clutch of Vikings, and the thing that linked them all was they all had death scenes. They all had very bravura death scenes. And I thought this was part of the mindset. And again, academics are not very good at different mindsets. I can't help thinking that, you know, the reason I'm different from that is, you know, early upbringing, which was kind of very, very much non-academic. So, but the thing that I identified in Viking mindset, you know, if you go on dating sites, guys actually like to advertise themselves as GSOH, good sense of humor, right?
Yeah.
Well, I said what Vikings had was BSOH, bad sense of humor. and this has not always gone well with modern academics, who shake their heads and say, tut, 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 how awful, what a terrible thing to do. Well, I'm sorry, I'm quite familiar with bad sense of humor. And I remember being carried off the field when I was playing rugby with my foot, you know, turned round at about 90 degrees to my leg because I'd got a broken tibia and fibula. And they were carrying me off on the stretcher, and all my mates were crowding around, laughing their heads off. They thought it was really funny. And they were all trying to make remarks like, how's about half price for your dance ticket, Tom? And things like that. And I was doing my best to reply, because that's what you do, isn't it?
Yeah.
That's what you do. But this sense of humor is, although very prevalent in the world today, it's not very prevalent in academia, where everybody's very pushy. And, I won't say any more. I have to start getting angry again, you see.
But so, I don't want to work you up too much, yeah.
laughing, shall I die? Okay, that's laughing. Yeah, yeah. Good joke. What do they say in the military? If you get blown up, if you can't take a joke, you shouldn't have joined up. That's bad sense of humor. Righto. Well, yes.
I saw the other day, to switch gears here a little bit, I saw Uppsala shared a image of a letter that you got from Professor Tolkien.
Yeah.
Yeah, so you're probably one of the, you know, few folks you know, around who have a personal correspondence and with Professor Tolkien. What were your interactions with Tolkien like?
Well, I only had one long conversation with him, which was when I went to dinner at Merton College with his successor, Norman Davies. Norman said, this is when I got appointed to a job at Oxford. He said, come on, he said, you better meet the old man. So we did. And I'm rather pleased about that, actually, because as soon as I got there, I realized that Tolkien was a bit cautious. He'd been interviewed so often. He didn't want to be grilled anymore. So I didn't grill him. I just talked to him as one hobbit to another. And I told him what was going on in Birmingham, and what was going on at the old school, which we both attended, and what was going on at the old rugby club, which we both played for. And Tolkien, I think he really liked that. He actually grilled me on it. he wanted to know what our fixture list was like. Oh, you play Old Silhillians? Yes, I said, and we beat them too. Hooray! you still play Bromsgrove? Yeah. And then he wanted to know the names of the guys in the team. And he was very, very interested in a guy called Peter Neave. And I realized many years later that was because he thought it might be a cousin of his, because his aunt, you know, was Jane Neave. I didn't realize what he was getting at. And of course, I didn't actually know anything about Peter's family. But he wanted to know the names of all of them. And I could see him thinking, I wonder if that's my old mate's grandson.
Yeah.
And it probably was, you know. There was a very, very great continuity in the school. So I'm very pleased we had a kind of, what should I say, no pressure chat.
Yes. Yeah.
That was good. But what I did recognize, of course, was that Tolkien was very interested in names. And he would ask me where I thought the etymology of this or that was, and I'd have a go at it, and he'd sort of say, no, I think. So that was good. Indeed, it came up another time, not me, but I was talking to a colleague of mine at St. John's whose name was Sturzacker. And I said, oh, that's a German name, isn't it? Yeah. Sturzacker. He said, nope. I said, what do you mean? He said, it's Old Norse. I said, what do you mean? You don't know anything about Old Norse. You're a mathematician. So how do you get, what does Sturzacker mean? It says, it's Old Norse, and it means the field of strife. And I said, how do you make that out? He said, Tolkien told me. So that was me out, you know.
Okay, yeah, you can't argue with that, can you?
Argue with that one, yeah. Good, so that was fine. So he obviously did that to, I think, basically to anybody. I wish we could have talked more about that too. We could have talked about some interesting names. Yeah. Let me think now. Yeah, go on.
No, go ahead.
Well, let's see. I mentioned my Beowulf for the North of all the Vikings. We got the Beowulf translation and commentary. We mentioned the Laughing Shall I Die. Is there anything else? Anyway, look on tomshippey.com, and if I've forgotten something, it's there. And there's also this article, which I put on Academia, academia.edu. If you go to that and put in Tom Shippey, a list of papers will pop up, I think. And if you put in the title, that will certainly pop up, and you can download it, which might be of interest to people interested in Tolkien. So, look at Academia, Edu. I wish I didn't have to do this, you know, but I put these things up because I think the kind of commentary in the Tolkien studies area is often so poor. And so I'm trying to get people to read it for themselves. But I don't know. Tolkien's become academically respectable, but I'm not sure I like that. I'm not sure I like that at all. I, as my old pal Peter Weston said, talking about science fiction, which is also becoming a critical field, said, no, he said, we should stay in the gutter where we belong. Well, I can see the force of that as well.
Yeah. Now, you mentioned, you know, your conversation and experience with J.R.R. Tolkien. Now, I'm kind of the generation where, you know, everything that came out during my lifetime has been put out by Christopher editing his father's works. What kind of interaction, you know, did you have correspondence and things of that nature with Christopher?
Not much, but I contributed to his memorial volume. I'm sorry he didn't get to read it. And I remember one incident. I was a fellow at Oxford 72-9, and then I went off to be a professor at Leet. But sometime after that, I forget what would be the appropriate date. It was a kind of, it was an anniversary of some kind of the publication of The Hobbit or Tolkien's birth or something or other. And there was a conference at Oxford to celebrate Tolkien. And I turned up to give a speech. And before the conference, I rang up the guy who eventually inherited Tolkien's chair, the chair of Anglo-Saxon. And I said, are you going to come along, say something? He said, nope. I said, oh, come on. You wouldn't have a chair if it wasn't for Tolkien. That's a bit of academic gossip I'd probably better keep quiet about. You ought to come. You ought to show your face. Nope, he said he wouldn't. So when I gave my talk, you know, lectures here, lots of people facing me, I started off saying how nice it was to be in Oxford, where Tolkien had been such a prominent person, and how nice it was to see members of his English faculty who had come along also to celebrate him. And would they now like to stand up and be recognized? And then I waited. And the audience, who didn't realize I was joking, were all looking around. And I said, oh, isn't that funny? There's nobody here. And I could see Christopher at the back grinning all over his face because he had seen the joke, and he also was no fan of the Oxford English faculty. So we both enjoyed that that little bit of vengeance.
Yes.
Know?
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh yes, it was terrible. I could go on about that, again, some things better not said, perhaps.
I always, you mentioned earlier, having the searchable, when you were looking up how many times the word heathen is used, and the search function, I feel spoiled in that, anytime I want to, look up, or try to remember a particular passage of Lord of the Rings, I'm like, oh, I can remember this bit of a phrase. Where does that fall? And I just search it. And, looking back to previous scholarships it's done, and I was reading recently in the book you mentioned, Great Tales Never End, them talking about Christopher and never using digital means. Like, he was using photocopies a lot of times and stuff. And, it adds to the impressiveness of, a lot of this early scholarship and everything that, you realize how spoiled we are nowadays with that search function.
Yeah, yes, quite so. And indeed, it's very informative. I can't remember now where I wrote it, but in one of these pieces, perhaps it's the one I was talking about, I looked up the word hero, and I realized how rarely Tolkien uses it. And considering he's the founder of heroic fantasy, you'd expect it to pop up a bit more often, wouldn't you?
Yeah.
But actually, it occurs very rarely, and often in a sense you would not expect.
Yeah.
I won't go into that, but it's an interesting exercise as well. So I do that quite often, actually, do search for this word or that word, and you always learn something.
All right. Well, Tom, it's been so great chatting with you. I like to end these with some rapid fire, questions. So these can be one word responses. You can elaborate a little bit. There's no rules here. But who is your favorite Middle Earth character?
Ugluk the Orc.
Really?
Yep.
And why is that? I need an explanation for that.
I admire his attitude to discipline. So often when I was a chair and my colleagues were whimpering and gabbering away, I think, I'd like to go slash, slash, everybody do what I say. I wasn't a very successful administrator. They didn't like me much. Oh, well, more fool them. Okay, that's that.
That's
one.
A good one. That's a good one.
Yeah, yeah.
What if you could live in a location in Middle Earth, what would you choose? Where would you choose to live?
Probably the northern edges of Mirkwood.
Okay, yeah. That's a good one.
Yeah. Mm. I think I like woods. I like forests. I think, somehow I get along very well in them. That's all right. So, yes, yeah. I'd go for that. Yeah.
Very good. What is your favorite Tolkien book out of all the books of the professor?
Well, of course, not much doubt, really, is there? It's probably the Two Towers.
Okay.
Actually, yeah. Okay. If you asked me why, I wouldn't know, but that's my impression. Yeah.
And then, what are some of your favorite non-Tolkien books?
Look at the shelves behind me. and I may say those are only a fraction of the shelves in this house. You can see on the sort of right-hand one, as you look at it, rank on rank of science fiction magazines, and there's many, many more in this house. Double banked very often because I can't get them in any other way. And I've got a lot of fantasy books as well. But I would say, you know, I was impressed by George Martin, who used to be a science fiction author. And then, you know, he went to the dark side and became a fantasy author because it's much more profitable, isn't it? And the other one I think I would pick out, well, the other two I would pick out are Stephen Donaldson, author of the Thomas Covenant series, and also Michael Swanick, author of the Iron Dragon series. So, you know, all these guys are very, very good. Very good indeed. My word, I think there's more talent in the fantasy area than there is elsewhere.
Yeah.
How does Author of the Century start? It starts, fantasy is the dominant literary mode of the of the 20th century. So let me just say one thing before the cough overtakes me. Having recommended this book to everyone, you know, go to UppsalaBooks.com, have a look at it. But another thing I think you could well do is follow on Twitter and on, well, it's not Twitter anymore, you know, but on Instagram, on Facebook, on YouTube, on social media generally. Look for at Uppsala Books and see what strings of comments you can find there. And we'd really like you to do all that so that you can see what we're doing and perhaps think of us for the future as well.
Yeah,
not just for the present. At Uppsala Books on social media. And buy the Beowulf book as well.
Yes, definitely pick up the Beowulf. Again, that's by Dr. Tom Shippey, who is kind enough to join us today, as well as we'll give a shout out to Leonard Nydorf, who helped set up this interview and is also right here on the cover.
And don't forget Bhagavad Gita, which is the kind of, I'm not sure how to call it, it's a kind of guide to the battlefield of life.
Mm.
And my word, don't we all need one of those? Yeah.
I think we could all do with that for sure.
Yeah, yeah.
And we'll put the links in the description. Uppsala's got the talk that you mentioned earlier, the 60 years of Tolkien talk on their YouTube channel. We'll link to that as well. Well, Dr. Tom Shippey, thank you so much for joining me today. Like I said, it's been an absolute honor to have you as someone who's long appreciated your work in the Tolkien fandom and the greater sphere of Tolkien. You're indispensable, and it's been an honor to have you.
Well, thanks very much, Matt. And maybe we can talk again sometime when something else comes up. Yeah,
absolutely.
Thanks so much for listening to this audio podcast of Nerd of the Rings. To get the latest Middle-earth related videos, including Tolkien Explained, Complete Travels, and Theories, visit youtube.com/nerdoftherings. This audio podcast is made possible by the support of my wonderful Patreon supporters. To learn how you can score some exclusive perks while supporting the channel, visit patreon.com/nerdoftherings. Thanks so much for listening, and we'll see you next time on Nerd of the Rings.